It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting today. Follow us at KUOW. Tomorrow is a big day for Boeing. About 3,000 machinists who work on Boeing's 787 Dreamliner in South Carolina will be voting on whether to join a union, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. It's the same union that represents more than 30,000 Boeing workers here in the Puget Sound region. There's a lot at stake for both the company and the union. Alwyn Scott is a reporter for Reuters, and he says it's been a contentious campaign.
Boeing has been very aggressive, you could say, about promoting its side of the argument. You know, you don't need a union between workers and management. Unions are divisive. They just take your money and spend it on their own salaries. They can't really deliver anything. They can promise you a great contract, but they may not be able to deliver it. And they will lead you out on strike, inevitably, and particularly the machinists, which do have a history of striking in Seattle. And that'll be money out of your pocket that you'll never recover, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's Boeing's line is vote no on the union. You just don't need it in South Carolina.
And what is the union saying? What's their main point?
The union is saying, you know, workers in South Carolina are paid significantly less than workers in Seattle. They don't have as good control over their work hours, things like mandatory overtime or changes in the schedule that might disrupt their plans. If you have a weekend plan and suddenly you have to work, and they feel that, you know, the workers are doing the same work, they ought to get the same money and the same kind of job protections. Plus, just more broadly, you know, union protections are part of our democratic American process, and you're entitled to this as a worker, and you shouldn't be scared off from it by a company that says you don't need it. Well, it's always more powerful when workers collectively bargain.
It sounds like both sides are really pulling out all the stops on this campaign, and the company even aired an ad during the Super Bowl when ad time is pretty expensive, urging their workers to vote no. Let's listen to one of the ads that the company has produced.
Do you want to turn over your voice, your rights, and your future to a union that'll make decisions for you? The same union that just a few years ago tried to shut Boeing South Carolina down? Or do you want to continue to control your own future, keep your voice, and continue to have a real say in the future of our business? Tell them no again. Hopefully they'll hear your voice this time.
So that was an ad put up by the Boeing company urging workers to vote no. And it's interesting because it sort of alludes to some of the history of Boeing in South Carolina. And the machinist union here in Seattle kind of badmouthed the workers there, saying that, you know, the company shouldn't move its facilities to South Carolina because they didn't know what they were doing down there. Does that resonate with anyone there? Do people think that the union maybe is kind of the bad guy in this equation?
Well, certainly that's been the impression that Boeing's wanted to create. And it's true that the machinists were initially very much against the plant in South Carolina. In fact, they filed an unfair labor practice alleging that Boeing opened the factory there as retaliation for the strike in 2008. It was a 58-day strike that cost the company billions of dollars and you know, was very divisive. And they actually won that before the National Labor Relations Board. So, yeah, they did very strongly oppose it. When Boeing initially set up that factory and was making 787s, there were also quality problems. So the planes were being flown to Seattle and finished before they could be delivered, and a lot of rework was being done. And the workers in the Everett plant were understandably a little bit annoyed that the workers in South Carolina were not actually doing a very good job. Now it seems like that rift has been largely healed. I talked to the president of the local IAM District 751 here, John Holden, here in Seattle just a few days ago, and he was saying, you know, the workers here are very supportive of the workers there, want to have them enjoy the same rights of union membership as workers in Seattle. And, you know, they're posting messages of support on the Boeing Facebook page for South Carolina, sort of countering some of the posts from workers who are anti-union. They're really trying to lend their support to it and say, look, we're all part of the same manufacturing employee family, and we consider you brothers and sisters in our union effort.
How important is this vote for the company, and how important is it for the union?
Well, for Boeing, it's important because they don't want a union workforce at that plant. It's crucial for them not to have a strike. So if there was a union in South Carolina and there was a possibility of a strike there, that would be a problem. They don't have a no-strike clause, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have a no-strike clause in the contract there. So it's a big deal. Plus, just the whole point of having a less expensive, more flexible workforce in South Carolina is the whole point of doing that plant there.
And what would it mean for the union?
For the union, this would be additional money. They would get union dues from these 3,000 workers, which is important for them. Not all the workers, even if they were, even if the union was voted in, not all the workers would have to pay dues, but they would all be covered by the contract. So that's part of what this right to work state law means, that you don't have to be a dues paying member. But more broadly, the union, the whole labor movement would view this as a big victory in a very anti-union southern state.
And would it have an impact on the strength of the union here in the Puget Sound?
Oh, certainly would. It would bolster the sense that, you know, the machinists are a force to be reckoned with.
So you've been watching this campaign pretty closely. How do you think it's going to end up tomorrow?
I think it's very, very hard to say. I was out with people from Boeing and the union last night at dinner, and, you know, both sides were saying it's too close to call. We just don't know. It's interesting this time that there seems to be less local political support in South Carolina. In 2015, you know, the governor, Nikki Haley, who's now the UN ambassador, was sort of, you know, taking the podium and saying, you know, we cannot have Boeing unionized in our state. We're an anti-union state, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't seem to be saying that this time. And the other political leaders there have become a little more quiet. Hmm. So that's potentially positive for the union. However, you know, Boeing's argument is still very strong and a lot of fear about what a union might bring. It's gonna cost you money. They're not going to be able to give you anything, et cetera.
That was Alwyn Scott, who covers Boeing for the Reuters News Service. The vote in South Carolina that will decide whether 3,000 workers join the machinist union will take place tomorrow. And then on Friday, President Donald Trump is scheduled to visit the facility for the rollout of the newest version of the 787. Here's a question that's being asked a lot these days. Why is Washington State leading the legal fight to overturn President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration and refugees? There's no single answer, but KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reminds us of some recent and not so recent history.
First, the recent history. On November 20th, 2015, shortly after the Paris terror attacks, there was a rally on the steps of the Washington State Capitol to oppose allowing Syrian refugees into the United States.
ISIS must be destroyed.
Pro-refugee demonstrators also showed up and disrupted the rally.
Refugees are welcome here!
These dueling events made the local news, but the following day, something else happened that put Washington State on the national map in the debate over Syrian refugees. The New York Times published an opinion piece by Washington Governor Jay Inslee, a Democrat, headlined, "Why My State Won't Close Its Doors to Syrian Refugees." In that piece, he noted that in 1975, then-Republican Governor Dan Evans had welcomed Vietnamese refugees to Washington, quote, "even as other states turned their backs." The chair of the Washington State Republican Party wrote an open letter to Inslee saying there was a big difference, and Evans himself pushed back in an interview with KUOW.
It's very difficult to compare history with today's circumstances, and I think they're quite different.
Nonetheless, Inslee had positioned Washington as a beacon at a time when many governors were saying no to refugees from Syria. When Trump campaigned in Washington in 2016, he decried what he called the large influx of Syrian refugees into the Northwest and repeatedly wished the crowd lots of luck. Now, 9 months later, Washington is the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit that challenges President Trump's order to suspend the country's refugee program and block travel from seven mostly Muslim countries.
Breaking news tonight. A federal appeals court has just ruled against President Trump.
Suddenly, Washington State finds itself in the national and even international spotlight, as do Inslee and the state's Democratic Attorney General, Bob Ferguson. Ferguson has called Trump's executive order unconstitutional. Inslee has called it cruel and unjustifiable. And once again, Inslee has looked to history for comparison.
75 years ago, we saw this movie again.
Inslee was referring to February 1942, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, authorizing the relocation of Japanese Americans from the West Coast.
The Army provided fleets of vans to transport household belongings and buses to move the people to assembly centers.
Inslee noted he's from Bainbridge Island, where armed soldiers put more than 200 people of Japanese ancestry on a ferry to Seattle for eventual removal to internment camps.
I know from Bainbridge Island what fear can do, and I know that Americans need to stand up against this today across America.
FDR issued that order 75 years ago this week. But unlike today, then Washington Governor Arthur B. Langley did not resist the president's order. So what did he do? For that, let's step into a locked vault at the Washington State Archives. Archivist Benjamin Helley dug up a press release from Langley's office dated 2 days after FDR's order. It says that Langley has ordered all Japanese, that's the term, in Washington, to surrender to the state patrol
all firearms, ammunition, explosives, or other materials or instruments which might be used to injure property or life.
That's right. The governor ordered Washington residents of Japanese descent to give up their guns and knives.
Next Thursday, February 26, was set as the deadline for turning them in.
Step out of the archives and back into 2017, and the chair of the Washington State Republican Party says she's hearing support for Trump's executive order. Susan Hutchinson also has a theory for why Inslee and Ferguson are doing legal and rhetorical battle with Trump.
I have sources that say that Jay Inslee believes he could run for president.
This was Hutchinson at a recent news conference.
He's been more colorfully vocal in the last few weeks than I've seen him in the last 4 years.
She also suggested Ferguson was, in essence, launching his bid for governor in 2020. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke, and we're live tweeting at KUOW. How much are you willing to share with your social networks? How honest are you, really, in your social media posts, especially when things aren't going so well? Like, would you ever share a story about the time you didn't quite make it to the bathroom when you were studying abroad in rural India?
I ran down there, pounded on the door, and said, "I need to go to the bathroom right now. It's an emergency." By the time I got in there and squatted down in the hole, it was too late. I was stuck in rural India with so much poop in my pants and still coming out of me.
That was University of Washington student Noah Eisfelder reading a true story written by an anonymous UW undergraduate. It was performed last week as part of an event called the Vulnerability Collective. Lauren Middleman, a UW senior, organized it. She asked other undergraduates to submit stories they would normally not share about their challenges and failures.
It's hard to kind of be honest and be vulnerable, especially during undergrad, when we kind of just feel like everyone else has everything together. And so I really wanted to collect those stories that just aren't shared, that make someone doesn't feel comfortable sharing. Those are the most powerful ones. And if even one other person hears your story that has been through a similar experience, then, you know, that connection made is just invaluable.
So is this a common feeling among people of your age that life is supposed to be perfect and you're not supposed to share your failures or your challenges?
Yeah, especially with, you know, social media and everything right now. Everyone feels, and across the board, whether you're just entering college or about to graduate, that everyone else has their plan their life a little bit more put together than you. And that just can't be true. Everyone can't think that. That can't be true across the board. It's just this perception that we have. I remember when I was a freshman, I wasn't sure what I was studying, but everyone who was in a freshman direct into the Foster School of Business, I already felt like they already knew what they were doing. And now that I'm graduating, I feel like people already have these job offers that I don't have. So just kind of, I feel like it's across the board. Everyone feels like they are a little bit behind. And that's because people only share kind of the good, only, especially, again, especially on social media, people only share kind of the highlights.
So you are working under the rubric of a bigger project at the university called the Resilience Lab. And Anne Browning, you're in charge of that. What's the goal of the Resilience Lab?
I would say the goal is to kind of normalize these experiences of setbacks and failures and the occasional faceplant that we all go through. And as Lauren was saying, there's just this sense that we so curate what we share outwardly that what we've noticed is a lot of students are feeling pretty isolated and alone in their moments of biggest setback and struggle.
And this is a project that's happening not just at the University of Washington, but at other college campuses. So this
yes.
is something, this is like a thing now.
This is a thing. And I started having some conversations around resilience based on my own research that's been on student athletes and seeing their stories and kind of this idea of academic self-handicapping, that if something's not going well, if you're really pushing up against the limits of what you're capable of and you start to struggle, I was seeing students actually stop trying. And it was easier to not try and fail because then my ego wasn't on the line. If I really tried and struggled and failed, then it said something about my ability. So I would see these athletes kind of pull back from academic engagement as a way of kind of protecting themselves. And, you know, we start to ask, like, how else is this happening? Where else is this happening? And I actually connected with folks at Harvard University. They've had a success failure project. And Stanford University, they've had a resilience project as well. And there's actually kind of a resilience consortium of Ivy League schools and kind of a broader base that we're a part of now that are really looking at kind of this issue of students who come into universities, and as my colleagues at Stanford say, they're seeing their students enter as failure deprived. This notion that they've got these pristine resumes and somebody has kind of grabbed them by the scruff of the neck and saved them before they ever face planted. So as a student sitting down in, you know, kind of a difficult chem class for the first time and they get hammered on a midterm, suddenly that moment of first failure is what you're experiencing as a college student when, you know, I could name plenty of failures I had long before I entered undergrad. And so trying to kind of help students really kind of see these struggles and setbacks as moments of growth and opportunity.
So I'm a lot older than you guys, and I have actual teenagers at home. So I'm wondering, is this a failure of my generation parenting? I mean, have we raised a generation of kids who have not failed, don't know what failure is, and can't cope with failure?
I think we have a different level of expectation for what a, you know, potential 18-year-old entering college should have on their resume and what that resume should look like. It's kind of this ratcheting up, like almost arms race of what that, you know, person should have experienced and can speak to.
There's this idea that millennials, which I think is awesome, but millennials can change the world. And you have the capability that when you are in your 20s and young 30 and whatever, and when you're young, you can really have this huge impact. And there can almost be a feeling that if you're not doing that and you're not succeeding, then you're not doing something right.
I want to talk more about the stories that you collected and that were performed last week at the UW. Some were pretty lighthearted, like the story we heard of the kid who had the bathroom accident in India, but some were pretty heavy. Let's hear a little bit of those.
When I was 12 years old, I was sexually abused. I think I make jokes because that's a defense mechanism. At the time, he was charged with child molestation. Because that was the charge, I agreed, yeah, that's what happened. I didn't know what rape was, as I didn't even know what sex was. I still, to this day, as a college student, trying to understand what had happened to me.
2. That's the number of eyes I have, the number of gears on my chain wheel,
and the number of times I nearly committed suicide in college. Once during my freshman year, and again during my senior year here at UW.
I've never admitted my feelings regarding pornography to anyone. I've never felt like I could be open about it. The reason that this is such a struggle is because I don't believe a pornography addiction fits into society's norms of what a struggle should look like. I don't go out and drink all the time. I'm not addicted to alcohol. I don't go out and hook up with strangers. I'm not interested in the hookup scene. It feels like a problem that most people wouldn't understand or even be sympathetic about.
So, Lauren, these were stories that you collected. They were about suicide attempts, loneliness, sexual abuse, academic failures. When you started seeing these stories, were you surprised by all of these really tough issues that were out there?
I wasn't surprised by the issues. The biggest thing I was surprised about was these students' excitement to share their stories, even though they were so dark. I did a bit of marketing to reach out to students, and I just got an influx of emails from students I have never met, and they heard about the project and really, really, really wanted to share their story.
What is the really big picture goal of what you're doing, Lauren, and the whole Resilience Lab? I mean, what do you want people at the university to know about and to take away from all of these stories and these experiences that you're sharing?
To me, the Vulnerability Collective is about sharing those incredibly hard experiences. And I think there's this sense of agency and kind of empowerment that comes with suddenly putting a voice to the very hard experience. And there's a connection that happens. And there's also this then kind of wraparound support. You know, to me, in that venue last night, you kind of felt this level of support for the people who had experienced and really kind of, you know, respect for the courage it took to share those stories.
That was Anne Browning from the University of Washington's Resilience Lab, and also Lauren Middleman, who put together stories from UW undergraduates called the Vulnerability Collective. If you want to learn more and find out about the next event of the Resilience Lab, we're tweeting out a link now. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. Executive orders, late-night tweets, alternative facts, all coming at a frenzied pace. Many of you may be exhausted trying to keep up with the news coming out of the Trump White House. Tech entrepreneur Jan Miksovsky understands that. He didn't want Trump to win the election, but now he's trying to catalog all the news on the Trump administration at a website he built called Presterity. The name's a combination of the words press and posterity. Miksovsky created the site as a reaction to the election of Donald Trump, but it was a little bit of a delayed reaction.
I think after the election, it was probably 3 weeks of just shock and, you know, despair. I really had no sense of what I could do. And, you know, I was concerned about the fear of information overload. And even just during the campaign, it was hard to keep up. So I was really concerned about, you know, what would happen when there were not just 20 bad things happening every day, but 200. And it was only around the end of November that I began trying to sort of shake off my despair and think about this as maybe a designer or a technologist would, which is be to, you know, that's my background. I've done that for 30 years. Like, what can I, as someone who tries to design solutions to problems, contribute? And so I began to think, is there a problem in here that I can help solve? And I decided to focus on that problem of information overload and documenting facts.
So tell me about the site and, mm-hmm. and what does it do?
So the site is created by volunteers as a way of documenting the events of the Trump administration and with a particular focus of news of concern. So we're trying to take when we see something go by in the daily news cycle that's alarming to us and we think is either something of historical importance or of particular concern to a group, then we flag it for inclusion in the site. And then we have a process by which people organize that information into a site that anybody can come to and become informed.
So who is this website intended for?
The main audience we view the site for are people who are working on the front lines of resistance. So it could be advocacy groups, it could be watchdog organizations like the ACLU, it could be legislative staff in different state campaigns, and then citizen activist groups. So if someone's trying to understand a particular topic and wants to have essentially a dossier created for them on the topic, then they can go to the site and find everything about the Dakota Access Pipeline or Trump's misogyny, say. And so we look at ourselves as essentially a reference desk for the resistance. We have no big egos. We're happy to play a supporting role in the story to create this this resource that these other groups can use.
If it's mostly just aggregating mainstream media articles, though, I mean, how is it any different than going to Google and just searching Dakota Access Pipeline?
One of the challenges when you're trying to understand a particular topic is a basic challenge is understanding a sequence of events. So as a starting point, we create for each topic a timeline that makes it much easier for someone to see how the thinking on a particular topic has evolved or where something came from. And it helps to place other information in context. So if you're researching a particular story or a particular bill, you may have an article that you found through Google that's got a date on it, and you want to understand where did this fit in the timeline of events. Was this before Trump said that horrible thing or after he said the horrible thing? And so having a timeline to refer to really helps organize that that consideration of the topic. So that's a key thing, is to be able to have a picture of the whole story as it unfolds. And that's something that you can't get from Google or Wikipedia or some other site. So that's a key thing.
Do you expect the vast majority of the readers of this site will be people who are anti-Trump? I mean, you're not expecting any supporters of Trump to be visiting anytime soon?
No. You know, they've proven resistance to facts already, so I don't think we're going to be the ones to change their minds. I think that, you know, we welcome contributions and readership across the political spectrum. So I think to the extent that this is anti-Trump, many people will look at it as being liberal. I look at it really as anti-Trump and sort of anti-lying. So if you're a conservative and you're concerned about things that Trump is saying about interfering with the free market or free trade, then, you know, you should be able to come to the site and find news that's relevant to you. And we would welcome contributions from someone like that.
You said earlier that after the election, you were really shocked by the results. And I know there's been a lot of hand-wringing about how we've each been, you know, both sides of the political spectrum have been sort of encased in their own bubbles and not really understanding the other side. And I know you're not a journalist, so you have no obligation to fairness in this issue. But isn't a website like this sort of allowing people to become more encased in their bubbles rather than trying to get out of their bubbles?
I do, you know, struggle with the question of how do we avoid making the situation worse as we try and share our information? How do we do it in a way that is not targeted solely at people who are already living in a particular news bubble, but do that in a way that could be appealing to a broad range of people? But as you say, I'm not a journalist and I'm no, you know, media innovator here. So I think we just do our best job at focusing on facts and then hope that that will be enough.
So in the little summaries that you write, are you trying to keep a neutral tone or is it really written for people that you know share your political views?
I wouldn't say that they share our political views. I think that, you know, and there's a range of contributors to the site. Like, I wouldn't say that everyone who's contributing to the site shares a consistent political outlook. I think everyone who, you know, the main qualification to join the project is to be deeply skeptical of Trump and his administration. And that does create a sort of lens we focus our attention, so to use those summaries as an example, when we're trying to summarize a topic, our interest is not in describing things that Trump has done that are positive on that topic. If that were to happen, if there were to be a positive development, Trump himself and all of his supporters will take care of making sure people know about it. Like, I don't feel like we're going to have to work hard to get that word out. I think really our focus is on documenting the events that the administration and Trump himself are trying to twist or alter or skew to their favor.
So this seems like a pretty big endeavor for basically for volunteers, and you have a full-time job. I'm sure this is taking up a lot of your time. How do you justify this time personally? Like, why is this important for you to do?
It's such a hard thing to answer. The first person that I talked to about the project was my wife, because I realized that if I were going to do this, it would take a lot of time. And so that would take me away from my family time. I have my wife and I have three kids. I love to spend time with them. And I've always, as in my working life, tried to keep a very clear boundary between my work time and my family time and keep that family time set aside. And since this was going to come out of that, I needed to sort of run that by her and see what she thought. And she asked me the question, do you want to do this or do you feel compelled to do this? And after thinking about it, I said, I think I feel compelled to do it. Like, this isn't something necessarily that I even want to be doing. Like, I don't relish the idea of spending 4 years, you know, spending my nights and weekends trying to document facts as they unfold when, you know, everybody should be doing that, and that shouldn't be a question. But that said, I think we're living in a reality where there are people resistant to facts and who are trying very, very hard to put out accounts of things that have happened that are counter to fact. And so I feel compelled to try and do my part to call out if the emperor isn't wearing any clothes. I want to say he's not wearing any clothes. And I think a lot of the people on the project feel similarly.
That was tech entrepreneur Jan Miksovsky. He runs Presterity in his spare time. We're tweeting out a link to Presterity now. Coming up later in the program, did you know that the person who invented computer dating was a woman and that she was working on it way back in the 1960s? We'll explore that story in honor of Valentine's Day. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates typically stays out of the limelight, except when he and his wife Melinda issue their annual letter from the Gates Foundation. It tells what the foundation has been working on and what it plans to do in the future. Todd Bishop from the tech news website GeekWire sat down for a rare one-on-one interview with Bill Gates, and Todd joins us now with the details. Hey, Todd.
Hi, Deborah.
So this year's annual letter is actually addressed to Bill Gates' friend and fellow billionaire, Warren Buffett. What's that all about?
So 10 years ago, Warren Buffett committed and pledged $30 billion to the Gates Foundation back in 2006. So the letter this time around from Bill and Melinda Gates is essentially a report card to Warren Buffett. And it's fascinating in part because here you have the head of Berkshire Hathaway. So he's used to talking to people about profits. If he invests in something, he expects a return. With the Gates Foundation, it's not profits, it's actually an impact on the world that he's looking for. And so in their letter, Bill and Melinda Gates are very much positioning their comments toward somebody with a business mindset, talking about the return on his investment.
And so this was a $30 billion gift, which basically doubled the size of the foundation. Can you remind us why Warren Buffett gave all that money to the foundation back then?
Yes. So Warren Buffett and Bill Gates go way back. They play bridge together. They were originally introduced by Mary Gates, Bill Gates' late mom. And they essentially started working together after Warren Buffett's wife passed away, and he was planning to have her run his foundation, and instead he decided to give away the bulk of his fortune to the Gates Foundation.
So the bulk of his fortune, I mean, like most of his money?
Yes. Okay. So and a lot of these billionaires have pledged to give away the bulk of their fortune through something called the Giving Pledge. So this is a reflection of that as well.
Okay. So how has the Gates Foundation been spending all of Warren Buffett's money?
They are big into childhood vaccines. And the reason for that is that childhood mortality is one of the leading indicators of the health of a nation, the health of a family, and it is something that they have, as Bill and Melinda Gates, really gone after in terms of trying to reduce the childhood mortality rates. And it's fascinating in part because this is an area of conflict with the Trump administration. Donald Trump has been very openly skeptical of vaccines, and particularly the link to autism. And Bill Gates met with Donald Trump when he was still in his pre-presidential phase, and Bill Gates talked to him about this. He said, hey, look, vaccines are important. They're innovative. They matter. And vaccine skeptics better get out of the way because we're going to save the world with these things.
So did Bill Gates talk about his conversation with Donald Trump? And what was his impression of the new president?
He did talk about his conversation with him. It sounded like Bill Gates was being very careful in my interview
with him. As he usually is.
Yes, he was. He very specifically said nothing critical of President Trump. In fact, I even asked as a follow-up for a statement on the immigration executive order that Donald Trump, because that happened after our interview, and he gave a very measured response about the importance of a global creative community, clearly not in line with the executive order, but not directly criticizing it as well. So he's kind of walking a fine line there. And this gets into things like energy and the environment. Bill Gates is launching a $1 billion venture fund to search for clean energy breakthroughs. And here you have Donald Trump, who has said that climate change is a hoax. So lots of interesting areas of conflict there.
So childhood vaccinations were the headline of this annual letter. What else is the foundation talking about right now?
Yeah, they also talked about some of the struggles. The financial meltdown in 2008 actually reduced a lot of the government aid that would normally complement the Gates Foundation's funding for various programs. And they said because of that, they think they actually had some setbacks in terms of the search for an HIV vaccine or the quest to get a better TB vaccine. So they actually did have some setbacks as well. But overall, they've seen an acceleration in the decline of childhood mortality. So in other words, the deaths are declining at a faster and faster rate, which to them is a sign that things are going well in the developing world, better than they have in the past.
Was there any addressing of the question of federal funding for scientific research and what impact a Trump administration might have if there are cutbacks in federal funding?
Yes, and that was specifically one of the things that Bill Gates talked to Donald Trump about when they met. Bill Gates is optimistic about this. He's an optimistic guy. Some of his former colleagues at Microsoft might be surprised by that because he was very pointed in his criticism back in the day. But he is reserving judgment. He is saying that he actually pressed Donald Trump to get behind an innovation agenda. For example, if you really pour money from a federal standpoint into clean energy research, that pays off for the country down the road, not only in terms of the businesses that it creates, but also in terms of energy independence. And so Bill Gates, at least, is still reserving judgment and hoping that things are going to go well in terms of federal funding for scientific research.
Well, at a time when you have a lot of tech leaders who are taking very public stands against Donald Trump, does Bill Gates see himself as somebody who might be a moderating, someone who might keep the door open to Trump administration?
He didn't say that explicitly, but it sure seemed that way, almost in the same way that Elon Musk is, except, of course, Elon Musk is actually on the president's committee in that way. And Bill Gates, when Donald Trump was running for president, he said, maybe we ought to shut the internet down when they were having all the hacks. And he said, let's get Bill Gates on that. So, it's just a reminder that Gates, for all of his familiarity to us here in the Pacific Northwest, he's an international icon and people see him and they think of technology. So he has a certain influence just because he's Bill Gates.
Yeah. What impact do you think, in other ways, the Trump presidency might have on the foundation?
The scientific research, the funding is a big one. And really that is the primary place.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Bill Gates does not give many interviews. And this is your second one that you've had.
Yeah.
So you talked to him the first time years ago.
Yeah. I've actually interviewed him a few times. But,
okay.
But the last time was when he was in his final days in the hallways at Microsoft back in 2008. So it was fascinating to be able to catch up with him nearly a decade later. His world is much bigger now. He's got a lot more things to think about. In some ways, you know, back in the day, he was in PC operating systems, and today the globe is his operating system, and he gets to figure out where the bugs are and how to solve them. So it's been fascinating to watch him do that. And to me, the real headline here was that he is very optimistic about the future of the world, and it's so stark, the contrast with what you hear out of the White House in terms of the state of the country and the gloom and doom that we tend to hear. Here is somebody who actually is looking at the numbers, looking at the data and saying, hey, it's actually pretty good. And if we just invest in the right things, it's going to get even better.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for catching us up there, Todd. Todd Bishop is the co-founder of GeekWire, and he joins us regularly on The Record. Thanks, Todd.
Thanks, Deborah.
It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. So here's a story in honor of finding love on Valentine's Day. Before there was Tinder or eHarmony, there was the St. James Computer Dating Service. It was started by a woman named Joan Ball. Joan lived in England in the 1960s. Her company was one of the first to use a computer and data to match people looking for a relationship. Susie Lee thinks there's a lot to be learned from the early days of computer-facilitating dating. She's the Seattle-based founder and CEO of the online dating app Siren. She explained how Joan Ball got into the business of computer dating.
In 62, when women were not even allowed to go outside at night without a male escort, she was a businesswoman who was starting her own businesses. So she had run something in 1962 called, and it's an awesome name, the Marriage Bureau.
This was not a government agency.
This was not a government agency, but it was probably a mandate to say, you know, how do you pair up people and match people? So she was like a matchmaker and a really good one, apparently.
Okay.
She saw the potential of using the computer to create algorithms in which you put in your data and she would start to match people that way. So you would go in, open door, and then at that point in time, you know, you would input things on the computer and then the computer would do its thing and then say, here are the four or five matches that you should be paired up with.
Wow. So this was 1962. So
yep.
What was the computer like, an entire room full of
it
equipment?
Was.
Okay.
It was. And people, you know, the public didn't understand anything about quote unquote technology. So when she said something about computer dating, people were horrified and said, does that mean you want to turn us into robots? Like robots were going to be doing the dating, which maybe that's actually happening now.
So what kind of questions would she have asked back then? What would people be telling her?
So things like, you know, what was important at the time, right? So whether someone had a job, probably their family history, what they were interested in, their, you know, activities like smoking or, well, everybody was probably smoking back then, whether they had kids. Religion was a really important one as well. The one thing that at the time she really didn't want to play on was race. So she told me a story about a woman that she said was, you know, amazing and brilliant and beautiful and, you know, kind of a perfect fit for this doctor. And the doctor came in and he met the woman and then he came back to Joan and said, I want my money back. I'm horrified. Mm. And the reason was that he was a white doctor and she had set him up with a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you didn't tell me that. And she said, I didn't think it was important for you to know. Because that wasn't the thing that made her her. She was a smart, brilliant, really engaged woman and matched in all these different ways. And so he said, oh, no, no, you should have told me. You should have told me. And she was furious at him. So Joan said, get out of my office. I don't ever want to see you here again. You're despicable.
Mm. Well, I know that matchmakers often say, okay, here's my success rate at, you know, matching people up and marriages and so forth. So did she have much success doing the matchmaking this way?
She did. And in fact, so Her site was called the St. James Computer Dating Service. So I think she was playing off a little bit of like the religion and that part of the aspect. Mm-hmm. And then she merged with another man at the time who was thinking about the computer dating. So they created another company together called Compat. And that company ended up competing with another company in England called Dateline. And she, you know, Joan said the guy who ran Dateline was just a businessman who was brutish and unpleasant and corrupt and blocked her ability on Compat to be able to advertise. So if no one knew about her site, this was 1964, 1965, then no one would know about it.
So she didn't succeed as a business?
So she wasn't able to succeed because this competing computer algorithm program basically took all the advertising dollars.
But this is interesting that there was competition back mm-hmm. in the 1960s for computer dating.
That's right.
I mean,
right.
This was a thing back then. This has been around for a while.
This has been, you know, I mean, if you think about the personal ads, this idea of kind of calling something out and then having a lot of people be able to see it. So using almost like newspapers as a way to say, hey, distribution network, this is how we're going to find it out. I mean, it was just a way to gather a lot of people who were like-minded and single and needed to get married. And everyone saw that there was a potential for doing this because computers could do it much faster in some ways.
Why are you so interested in this particular piece of history of online dating? What fascinates you about this?
So my background is as an artist and working in technology, and especially technology that I think can amplify humanity. And instead of making people into objects and gamifying everything, I said there are absolutely beautiful and moving ways that technology can bring people closer together. So I was kind of looking for my next project, and I was single at the time. And all of my friends who were, you know, professional women were like, oh my God, you have to try online dating, Susie. This is like this is what people do. And I'd never done it before. So I said, okay, sure. I mean, as artists, we're just very naturally social. So I just met all of my previous relationships by meeting people in real life. But the moment that I tried to create a profile, I thought, this is awful. Like everything that I feel like I bring to the table is being squashed in an online profile. And I felt super, super objectified.
Because it was too formulaic for you?
It was formulaic, but it was also like, here's a photo and try to basically market yourself as like why you're this amazing person or why you're being like worthy of dating in some way. And I thought the things that you can't tell on the profile are A, I'm funny. B, any kind of wish of or stereotype of what you think a quote unquote Asian woman should be like, I will smash all of those stereotypes. And so I thought, this is awful. Like, this is not really the way that I want to kind of put my foot out there and say I'm interested in meeting people.
Right.
So I said, I know how to do this better.
Right. And so you started your own site.
Started my own site.
Which is different. So the data idea, the matching people by their, you know, what they do or who they think they are, that doesn't work on your site? That's not how it works?
It doesn't, and it has been proven that that doesn't work in general. So when you look again at kind of the timeline of online dating, it kind of reached a peak where like places like Match.com, eHarmony, and OkCupid would say, give us as much data as possible, basically your entire resume, and we will promise chemistry by kind of the algorithmic special sauce. And then OkCupid said, this is baloney. We can't do this, and we can't promise chemistry this way. So at the same time, everyone started using their mobile phones, and they didn't want to read a whole bunch of text. So Tinder came out and was really the first site that activated how the phone was being used by people, which is swipes and taps, and said, well, basically all you need is a picture, and let's treat it like a big frat party, and guys will basically say, is this person hot or not? And that's how we're going to navigate our online dating. So that's where we are right now. And I thought, we can still do it better, right? We can still do it where it's not about data matching. It's about how do people converse with each other.
So it's more like a social media platform.
It is. So it's much more social in the sense that, so Siren has these daily questions, and we don't, you know, a computer doesn't create the questions. We actually source our community of creative individuals. So architects, dancers, artists, writers, they come up with our questions every week. And they're anything from where does rain sound best? That was a really popular question to us. To how many cats is too many cats? or we can be quite progressive and say, you know, what is what does feminism mean to you? And that was actually a really important question. And I remember when I was reading some of the responses of people, I thought, like, that's a hard question, I think, to put on a dating site. But when you just put it out there as a question and people start to answer, how people answer matters as much as literally the words that they say. So there was one guy that said, "Bleh, you know, feminism is like, eh, I don't think it's needed in 2017 or 2016. And I thought, see, I wouldn't want to meet you, you know?
Well, you were saying that your site appeals to a certain kind of person, artists or, you know, creatives.
People who can spell.
Are people going to be sort of gravitating to like smaller social groups when they're online and online dating in the future? As we are probably in life as well, we're navigating to smaller and smaller groups of people who are like-minded in real life.
I think so. I mean, right now they talk about niche dating, meaning these are the kind of interests you have, but they're kind of weird niches. So there's like one called Farmers Only, so that if you're into rural things, I guess. All things rural, you can do that. You know, there's obviously any kind of racial preference or like something like J-Date, which is for like people who are interested in the Jewish community. But I feel like that's a really limiting way of seeing how people can break themselves up in communities. So I think, you know, the beauty and what Joan Ball had said, even in 1963, the potential of online dating and computer dating that was beautiful was that it would actually start to cross over socioeconomic and geographic boundaries. And that's the beautiful part, right? Because, you know, we're talking now about how in 2017, all of us seem really isolated and kind of in our own bubbles.
Yeah.
And at least when I looked at the kind of relationships that I thought were really magical in my life, they were always things that were completely unexpected.
Surprising, yeah.
And surprising. And, you know, I thought, well, how would I have met you on these sites? Well, I wouldn't have. I've always would have either swiped left or ignored you because, like, somehow there was something wrong about this person, except in real life, there was chemistry.
Right.
So I feel like the way that people can break themselves up in communities has to be on some level of shared values or some kind of sense of humor and not just on the sort of superficial idea of the activity. And of course, there are things that I think are really important to people, but those can be vetted through the conversation, I think.
It seems like as soon as technology allowed it, you know, back in the 1960s with Joan Ball, that people have been trying to find love through technology.
Yes.
What's the attraction? Why do people gravitate to that?
Well, kind of like pornography, like the moment that you could start putting pictures online, people started doing it. I think that technology has always been used to try to connect people. So right now, virtual reality is kind of a big thing. And everyone kind of says, oh, my God, now people are going to try to have sex in VR. And they sort of say it really dismissively with their eyes rolled. But it's true. That's actually what people are trying to do. So the hunger for what is fundamentally something that everybody needs and wants, we're absolutely going to use every tool that we can to do that thing. And that's why we end up doing that. It's just that historically, I don't know why, it's always been kind of creepy and shady people who have done that. So someone like Joan Ball is actually a really interesting outlier because she was really looking at it from a level of saying, as an expert matchmaker, how can I use this technology in a really positive way for people? And I think that I'd rather take that baton rather than some of the other like weird, historically creepy sites.
Susie Lee is the Seattle-based founder and CEO of the online dating app Siren. We talked about Joan Ball, the woman who invented computerized dating back in the 1960s. You've been listening to The Record on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Deborah Wong, and Bill Radke will be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening. The BBC is next.